Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to a New Day radio show where the dialogue is authentic, host is passionate, and we help you to become empowered, inspired, resilient, and transformed. Yes, our focus is to change our world by transforming one business and one life at a time. Now, here is your host, author, columnist, reinvention coach, entrepreneur, teacher, and speaker, Dr. Daphne Clark Hudson.
Good morning, and happy Wednesday to each and every one of you. I just hope you're having a great day or night for some of my listeners, depending on where you're calling from. Again, today is another day when we inspire, empower, and educate our listeners to be the best that they can be, both in their personal lives and also in their career life. And today we have a special treat for you. We have a legal expert who will be coming on for the first 10 minutes of the show and to give you some nuggets on internet law. So grab your pads and paper, because you will want to take note. And we are joined by attorney Ariella Mitchell Durant, who is intellectual capital property attorney, and we are going to have her on. So needless to say, this segment of the show is brought to you by none other than AMD Law Group. And then after we play their commercial, then I'm going to bring Attorney Durant on live. So in the meantime, grab your pens and paper so you can take some notes.
AMD Law Group is an international law practice committed to assisting you in realizing your strategic business goals. Led by Ms. Ariella Mitchell Durant, Senior Managing Partner, AMD Law specializes in international business, international intellectual property, and general internet law. We also support organizations in resolving corporate compliance issues. Addressing the legal needs of technology firms and other businesses serving both domestic and international markets, we are uniquely positioned to assist both startups and long-established organizations. Although AMD seeks to proactively avoid litigation wherever possible, we are fully capable and ready to litigate on your behalf. AMD Law Group. Find us online at amdlawgroup.com or contact us at 347-699-4AMD. That's 347-699-4263. Let us help you pursue and protect your dreams.
All right. And now let us welcome the senior partner, Attorney Ariella Mitchell Durant. Good morning, Attorney Mitchell Durant. How are you?
Good morning, Dr. Daphne. How are you?
I am wonderful, and thank you for coming on this morning to enlighten us. And I want the listeners to know that on the third Wednesday of each month, they can look forward to some expert tips from you. So I want to hand the mic over to you, please.
Okay. Thank you for having me today.
I wanted to talk
to your audience a little bit about internet law, and particularly how you manage and properly operate your website. One of the things that we think in business when we start up is that the first thing we need to do is set up our online presence. And we go to GoDaddy or one of the other service providers, and we secure our domain and we set up our website. But one of the things that I want to share with your listeners is that when you set up a website, you're actually engaging in commerce, no different than if you had an actual storefront. So that means that there are other requirements than just making sure that your homepage looks proper. One of those requirements is that you have a terms of use page that lets your website visitors know what the intention of the website is, so that if you have information on the website, they don't misconstrue or misappropriate any of the information. And that's something that a lot of people that set up a website don't realize, is that it's your online storefront is what your website is. So you have to make sure that you protect yourself from the public that might misunderstand the intention of the website. And the way you do that is by setting up a terms of use page on how your particular website is used or intended to be used. And the other one of the other things that you would do is, you know how you see people that capture email addresses on their website? They might give out a free gift of some sort. Well, whenever you capture any information on the internet from any person, you are required to have a policy statement as to how their privacy is protected. So that means that you would inform them that either I am or I'm not going to sell your information. Either I am or I'm not going to sell your name to a third party. And that's something that you have to do in order to protect yourself from invading the privacy of the people that are going onto your website and purchasing your free gift item. So that's the second point. The third point that I want to make is that, you know how you see people that run ads on their website? They might have Google AdSense where there are ads that are running in the top banner or on the side of the website.
Yes.
Well, once you accept ads onto your website from third parties that are not affiliated with you, you have to have a disclaimer on your website that those people are indeed third parties and they're not associated with you, so that if someone clicks on one of those ads and goes to that particular site and they suffer some harm, monetary harm or some damages, that they're not looking at you as the source. So that you explain to the public that, yes, I have ads, but they're third-party ads. They are not my ads. I'm not responsible for what happens to you once you click off of my site and go elsewhere. So those are the three important things that you need to know about internet law and what it means to have a properly functioning website. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that I want to share today.
All right. Thank you so very much. And I know that a lot of people is having their hands over their mouth and saying, OMG, because, I mean, I think most people's website is incorrect, because I don't see on too many sites where they have all of this information on there. So I want to just thank you for coming on and giving us these nuggets. And tell people again how they can reach you.
Well, our website is amvlawgroup.com, amvlawgroup.com. You can reach us at contact@amvlawgroup.com if you want to send an email. And the telephone number is 347-699-4263. And that's how you can reach me.
All right.
We do offer a website review where we'll take a look at the website and make suggestions for you on what you can do for your website. Yeah,
wonderful.
So you can do that as well.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. So, we look forward to hearing from you again the third Wednesday of next month. This is wonderful. Thank you very much, Attorney Michelle Durant.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Daffy. Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure, ma'am. Have a great day.
All right, you
too. Wow. Yes. Isn't this amazing? We never know. There is so much to learn. There's so much out there to learn. And these are really good nuggets. And if we listen to this, we will protect ourselves. Because she's so right. We are always rushing to go into getting the website up and getting the squeeze page, and especially where she mentioned about people doing Google AdSense and all of that. There are a lot of marketers, internet marketers, who are that's their livelihood of doing the ads and sign up and that, and you're not sure about how to do it. So utilize them. Utilize them to review your website for you and to make recommendations. So that was really powerful, powerful information, and I thank her for coming on. Well, today I am teaching on success and decision. That's what I'm going to be talking about today. Decision and success, because I see those two topics as a twin. They come together. A lot of times we don't realize the impact that our decision has on holding back our success. And before I even go into that, this is the time when I need to play the team song. Well, you know, I should have played it before Attorney Michelle Durant got on. So, yeah, why not? Let me just play it now.
Some friends you gain, some you lose. In the back of your mind, you're looking for love, but found the blues. That's why I've come from far away, to take away the blues. And I've come to say, I wanna be more than just somebody. I wanna be more than just a friend. I want to be more than someone special, 'cause special friends sometimes they won't understand.
You know, I was sitting here listening to the song play, and it dawned on me the importance of keeping one's word. You know that on the 29th of March was 4 years since we have been on Blog Talk Radio. And for these 4 years, we opened with this song. But stepping over the threshold of the fifth year, we started using the voiceover, which you have been hearing. And one of my supporters and listeners, he sent me an email telling me how much he missed the song, this song that I play. And I promised him that I will still play the theme song. And I should have played it before I put Attorney Michelle Durant on, and I didn't, but I'm so thankful that I was guided back to play it, because it is important that I keep my word to my listeners and my supporters. I want them to be able to depend on what it is I tell them I am going to do. So just a word of insight for you. That you examine yourself, and whatever you say you're going to do, just make sure you do that. So, you know, I'm thankful that I was able to catch that and to do it before I got into the teaching here. So, there is a book in my library that the title is How the Wise Decide. The 12 Lessons of 21 Extraordinary Leaders. And I know that there's an extraordinary entrepreneur. There's an extraordinary small business. There is an extraordinary global leader in each and every one of us. So, I'm going to be using this book this morning to guide me along. And the number you can call is 646-915-8166. The chat room is open. And I welcome you to be part of this conversation. If you are using some techniques that you apply to making decisions, I would love to hear from you. So don't be reluctant to call in. The number to call is 646-915-8166. So let me take some time, and I'm going to read verbatim the preface for this book, How the Wise Decide, the Lessons of 21 Extraordinary Leaders. I want to read verbatim for you the preface that is done by the 21 Club. It reads, to declare war or not to? That was the question. John Whitehead knew he would have to make a decision soon. His competitors had already made theirs, and Goldman Sachs was coming under increasing pressure to declare its intentions. For years, Goldman had quietly competed with four other top-tier Wall Street investment banks for the business of America's largest companies. All five banks had been successful enough to make their partners very wealthy. Then Morgan Stanley fired the first shot in a new kind of warfare, agreeing in July of 1974 to help International Nickel Company launch a hostile takeover bid for electric storage battery. The unthinkable, one company trying to seize the assets of another through financial force, had suddenly become possible. It didn't take long for the Fiverr to become contagious. Corporate executives across the nation were desperate. Many believed they were trapped. Either they took over another company or they faced being taken over. The stakes were enormous, and the investment banking clients were willing to pay astronomical fees for the help in launching hostile takeovers. Yet, amid all the feverish takeover action, the partners at Goldman Sachs could only watch from the sidelines. Whitehead, the co-chairman of the firm, hadn't yet given the go-ahead for the firm to advise its own clients on how to launch hostile offers. Whitehead knew that helping clients make hostile tender of offers would be enormously lucrative, and anyone not taking part in the merger mania risk being relegated to the second tier of the investment banking. Yet, to Whitehead, it didn't seem as if his competitors were really helping their clients. Many of the hostile deals were turning out badly for both the acquirer and the target company. The executives at the acquired company often left in anger, and the combined company failed to realize the hoped for the benefits of the combination. Whitehead believed it just wasn't good business. Whitehead made his decision. Goldman Sachs would not offer its services to any company to make a hostile tender offer. He wanted the firm to be known as the Investment Bank of Integrity. We thought that good ethics was good business, and that in the end, people wanted to deal with the investment banking firm they respected the most, not necessarily the one that was the biggest or had the largest share in the market, he says. The repercussions of that decision and its public announcement were immediate. A client company turned away from Goldman to retain another firm to help it launch a hostile bid. Goldman's competitors were soon posting record profits on the large transaction fees that floated from hostile deals. Some Goldman partners argued that the firm was leaving enormous potential profits on the table. Junior bankers watch friends at another bank bringing home big bonus checks, but Whitehead remained steadfast. Goldman was the firm of integrity. Then something unusual happened. As word of Goldman's stance spread, companies threatened by hostile bids turned to Goldman as the firm of choice to defend against the unfriendly offers. And that prompted executives at companies that weren't threatened to look at Goldman for investment banking advice. Two, confident the bank would turn on them in the future. It didn't happen overnight, but Whitehead's decision to stand firm against making hostile offers set it apart from its competitors and created an enormous demand from companies that wanted to do business with a firm of integrity. Whitehead's decision to eschew hostile takeovers and forgo the lucrative paychecks has become a Wall Street legend. It cost Goldman at first, but eventually created an aura around the firm that has evaluated it to preeminence on Wall Street. Making great decisions isn't easy, yet the cumulative decision we make will largely determine our success. The fact that over 80% of new products failed after launch, and over 50% of mergers and acquisitions destroy more value than they create is testament to how difficult it is to make and implement decisions in business today. In our first job as managers, we certainly felt enormous pressure to make great decisions. Yet, we also felt unprepared to make them, despite our training at Harvard Business School and McKinsey and Company. How did John Whitehead know to make the legendary decision? He didn't know, but he had a powerful urge to tap into the kind of wisdom. And we weren't alone. Glenn Hubbard, just before becoming dean of Columbia Business School, acknowledged that students had even the best business schools need to better understand the process that will be a critical factor in their future success. I worry that MBA students here at Columbia or at Harvard Business School and other good schools have a great deal of skill, mastery, and technical mastery, but very little on either identifying opportunity or deciding among alternatives. And those are the things that are probably going to make or break you as a business person. When we couldn't find practical advice on how to make great decisions, we decided to answer a simple question. How do the really successful leaders make the tough calls? Our method was straightforward. Go to the source. We would find people who had made great decisions consistently and ask them how they did it. Ask enough successful and experienced leaders about their toughest decisions, and surely the essence of decision making would emerge. As it turned out, our first inclination, go to the source, became our first principle, confirmed time and again by many of the leaders we interviewed. This book is the result of our 3-year quest to learn how the wise decide. We sat down with some of the world's most talented and experienced leaders to understand how they make decisions. Our research captures the hard-earned lessons shared by the 21 extraordinary individuals based on their own most difficult and important decisions. Our wise leaders include John Whitehead of Goldman Sachs, David Maxwell, who is one of the 2 living members of Fortune magazines, the 10 greatest CEOs of all time, Justice Stephen Breyer of the U.S. Supreme Court, Stephen Schwarzman, Chairman and CEO of the Blackstone Group, the groundbreaking private equity firm, Harvey Gulop, who was responsible for turning around American Express in the 1990s, and Dermot Dupree, the remarkable but relatively unknown former Chairman and CEO of Sealair. Making great decisions comes down to timeless fundamentals. How the wise decide distills the six core decision-making principles that our leaders share and that every manager should know. The principles have guided wise leaders across functions and industries and brought them through various crises. The six principles go to the source, fill the room with barbarians, conquer the fear of risk, make vision your daily guide, listen with purpose, and be transparent. But as you will see in the stories of how these leaders made some of their most critical decisions, it takes extraordinary dedication to these principles to consistently make great decisions. You will also see what a powerful source these principles are for achieving remarkable success. Dermot Dunphy, who you will watch in these pages, transform Sealair from a stumbling $5 million packaging company to a $3 billion business on the cutting edge of technology, calls decision making the validation of leadership. As Dunphy explains, you may have charisma and personality. People may want to follow you, but not for long if they realize you are leading them in the wrong direction. This isn't a book about business theories. Rather, it is a practical guide written for managers by managers that provides the advice we will need to make great decisions consistently. Each chapter explores a single principle that is shared by our leaders. We begin each chapter with a short description of the principle, followed by stories to illustrate wise leaders using the principle to make critical decisions. The insights and nuances that emerged from the case studies are complemented by several practical rules that will help you make the principle part of your everyday decision making. Our goal is to accelerate your journey along the path to wise decision making and successful leadership. In these demanding times, when choosing the right direction is critical, you now can turn to the principles at the heart of how the wise decide. And if you just join me and you're listening, I'm teaching this morning and sharing from the book, How the Wise Decide, the lessons of 21 extraordinary leaders. I will still take your questions if you have some, or if you want to add. If you have read the book, I appreciate you calling in to share some nuggets from that. The number you can use to do that is 646-915 8166. So I am going to continue sharing verbatim. And we have how many chapters in this book here? We have 6 chapters. So again, I see myself doing this over 6 weeks because I know that this is really going to help us to make the right decision. So I will like do 1 hour for 6 weeks and then I'll have a guest for the other hour. So I hope you will enjoy this. So now let's look at chapter 1, go to the source. Remember the game you played in kindergarten in which the class, one by one, passed on a whispered statement? When the last child told out loud what she had heard, it was nothing like what the first kid had whispered. If you are like most people, you are playing a variation of that game every day in the office. Sure, you get authoritative looking reports to report and you sit through it, detailed PowerPoint presentations, but you are still getting the same kind of distorted and completed information that you got from your classmates in the kindergarten game. That lesson, that doesn't mean the information you get in the office isn't useful, but you are not going to the source to get first-hand information. Far and away the best kind of information. You may argue that you get out of the office occasionally to meet with customers or suppliers to learn what they are thinking, but that isn't what we mean by going to the source. Going to the source is the relentless pursuit of information from the field. It is hard work and it takes a lot of time, effort, and imagination. Do you devote 2/3 of your work life to going to the source? As CEO of Medtronic, Bill Gates did. That's how he got a bloody catheter thrown at him in the operating room and solved a serious problem confronting his company. Do you make more than 400 customer visits each year? That's how Mike Rutters discovered deep in the bowel of his customer data processing center the need for a new product that revolutionized EMC's fortunes. Do you travel the world studying how your business thrives in radically different environments? Or Simit found the solution to expanding Starbucks into untapped markets tucked away in the small towns in New Zealand? All three of these successful former CEOs share a passion for developing primary sources of information. It is one of the characteristics that define their success. They were placed another CEO, other CEOs didn't and heard things others did couldn't. They asked a lot of questions and listened carefully to the answers. They are not only got the best information, they also got it fast than anyone else. They were able to use that information to make important decisions about how to beat competitors, to market with new products, how to solve critical problems, and what sweeping organizational changes to make for profitable growth. For them, going to the source became a powerful competitive advantage. But how can Mike Reuters make 400 customer calls a year? How can Bill George spend two-thirds of his time observing complex surgery in the operating theater or talking to the Medtronic employees about developing new products or solving problems? The answer is that they value primary sources of information enough that they make going to them both priority and routine. Among all the things a CEO can be doing, they have decided that the largest portion of their time is best spent gathering unfiltered, unbiased information. Other tasks can be delegated. But first-hand observation and conversation require you to be where the action is, whether it is in the operating room or your own factory floor. Making important decisions can be stressful. Information may be skimpy, confusing, are contradictory, especially if it comes to us filtered and diluted through the mindset of people who think differently than we do. Wise leaders know that they can never have all the information they want. That's why it is critical to have the right information. They know that primary information gives them three major advantages over other kinds of data in reaching a decision. First, information at this source is unfiltered by others. Organizations invariably edit and distill information as it moves from level to level and from department to another. The result is a presentation or a report that purports to capture the essence of the problem. But that may miss or misinterpret some crucial pieces of information. Decision makers need to supplement this diet with unfiltered data. Information straight from the source that hasn't been manipulated or interpreted. Second, information at the source provides subtle details and nuances that get lost in second and third hand accounts. Reports and candid presentations lack emotional content, but the fact is that emotions play a large role in business. Without emotion, we can't appreciate the passion of a high potential customer or the frustration of an underfunded product development team. It's the decision maker's job to understand that what emotions are at part of are a part at play, and to use that understanding to make the best possible decision. Without face-to-face encounters with the people driving the future of your business, you will miss out on the power emotional input. Finally, information from the source is critical because it shows us reality. Too often, secondhand information distorts reality enough to give us a false sense of confidence. Only when we see things firsthand, how our products perform, what motivates our employees, what a customer really needs to do his job, do we have the breadth and depth of information to make the right decision? Comparing what we have personally seen and heard at the source to all that other information also allows us to put the secondary information in its proper context. The result is better decision. Primary sources are all around you, but you have to think differently about who they are. Going to see your customers is a vital part of learning how your product or service is used and how it can be improved. But most customers' calls involve peer-to-peer contact. CEOs visit CEOs. Salespeople visit purchasing agents. That's the wrong mix. To get the most useful primary information, you have to penetrate much more deeply into your customer's organization to discover the nitty-gritty details about what people on the firing line want from a supplier. The vice president of purchasing for a big hospital has never used a medical device in surgery, but surgeons have, and they have strong opinions. Similarly, a chief information officer isn't likely to have the same perspective on technology needs as the hired manager of one of the company's data processing center. Start looking for primary sources where it's easiest to find them in your own company. If you are in sales, for example, When was the last time you visited the credit department to check out on your customer's credit rating and how they have changed over the time? Is product development working on something that might benefit from some input from your customers? Outside your company, there is a vast array of potential sources of firsthand information beyond your customers. Think about potential new customers. And what about your customers' customers, suppliers, and competitors can be good sources of primary information. As our government regulations, investors, news reporters who cover your industry and academics who study it, making it a routine part of your job to go to the source will require a new mindset and a realignment of your priorities and the tendency to pursue first-hand information wherever it may take you. But if you become as skilled at using this powerful tool as the three leaders you are about to meet, you can beat competitors and new marketers and generate terrific new products. The bloody catheter. It was turning into a long, frustrated day for Bill George as he cooled his heels in the corridors of New York City massive Lenox Hill Hospital. George recently appointed the president and chief operating officer of Medtronic, Inc., a Minneapolis medical equipment manufacturer, was spending his first 90 days on the job learning about this company's products firsthand in the operating room. But today's procedure, an angioplasty using one of Medtronic's balloon catheter, had been delayed for hours while technicians scrambled to repair the fluorescent scope that would show the doctor the route to guide the small balloon into the patient's clogged arteries. The gruff German-American cardiologist that George would observe was furious that his busy schedule was being disrupted. Finally, the fluoroscope was fixed and the operation could begin. George, gowned and gloved, stood a few steps back from the operating table where the patient laid, swabbed, and sterilized sheeting. But soon after the doctor inserted the balloon catheter into the patient's femoral artery, the device fell apart in his hands. Ever so carefully, the surgeon withdrew the catheter from the patient. Then, with ill-concealed rage, he hurled the bloody device at George. Who ducked just in time to avoid being being smacked in the face, the operation resumed, this time with a competitor's catheter. George had been aware that Medtronic catheter sales weren't what they should have been. The company was losing market share, and the sale force had been complaining about product quality. But the engineers had said the product was fine and getting better. Maybe the sales force was just looking for an excuse for not doing a good job. He had thought, how shaken by that he had just seen. George sat down with the Medtronic sales rep, who had been with him in the operating room. The rep told him that the problem he had just witnessed wasn't an isolated incident. The catheters had been failing with disturbing frequency. All the sales rep knew that, he said, and they had all filed the required company reports. But George hadn't known it, and he wanted to know why he hadn't known it. Then, when he returned to his office in Minneapolis, he began investigating how information about the catheters were reported to headquarters. What he found was a tortuous path that rooted the sales reps' reports about failing catheters through seven layers of bureaucracy before they reached the people who designed the product. When George questioned the engineers about the reports, they denied that any design flaws existed and blamed the cardiologists for misusing the equipment. His investigation of the catheter failed led George to two conclusions. First, there clearly was a problem with the quality of the catheters. He had seen the problem with his own eyes, had been shocked by the incident, and had even brought the ruined device back to headquarters in his baggage. It's an overstatement, but field reports are a dime a dozen, George says. There's no emotional association with them. But when you are in the medical environment, like the operating room, all your senses, sight, sound, smell, taste are working. It's a totally different experience than reading a field report. Second, and more important, there are something dangerously wrong with Medtronic's ability to handle critical information. It was a systematic problem, he explains. What was wrong was that the system wasn't getting quality information from the operating room to engineer. Quality control and manufacturing, the people who could fix the problem, people didn't want to pass on bad news, and engineers can be in denial about a problem. George immediately ordered up a solution to the systematic problem. Within a few months, the catheter sales soar was split off from Medtronic Centralized Sales Operation and attached to the catheter division, where salespeople were in touch with closer contact of engineers, quality control, and manufacturing. At the same time, George ordered engineers to get out of their offices and spend at least one day a month in operating rooms, observing how the equipment they designed was used. A few engineers complained to him that they were too busy to waste time watching doctors. I said, if that's the case, you are working on the wrong things. George calls his traumatic experience in the Lenox Hill operating room a power of one observation. That single catheter failure crystallizes the problem confronting Medtronic in a way that no report ever could. But George wasn't basing his decision to overhaul the catheter business on that one experience. Instead, he was considering it in the context of everything else he knew about the business. He was able to see not only the flaws in the catheters, but also the flaws in how Medtronic handled information. Other power of one observations sparked more changes at Medtronic. One day, George was watching a surgeon implanting an early version of Medtronic's defibrillators, a device that restores normal rhythm to a wildly beating heart. The device was large, and the electrodes were delicate. The surgeon was having difficulty fitting the defibrillator into the patient's chest cavity. Finally, he pushed hard, and suddenly, blood was everywhere. The surgeon had perforated an artery. Surgeons are good at cutting, but they are strong, both in personal and physical strength. He was trying to force the device when that was needed, when what was needed was the refined touch of a cardiologist. George says the patient survived, but Medtronic's technicians began facing on making smaller defibrillators that cardiologists could easily implant without having to deeply invasive surgery. Then there was the day George spent in Loma Linda Hospital Pacemaker Fellow Clinic, where patients with recently implanted pacemakers come to make sure they are working properly. George hadn't understood at first why the cardiologist at the Loma Linda insisted he spent several hours in the crammed office, but he observed was mass confusion. Each brand of pacemaker and each model required a different monitoring system. Which brand the model did this patient have? Where's the monitor for this one? It was crazy, he says. He returned to headquarters and told his technical staff what he had witnessed. they immediately set out to develop a universal monitor that would be used with any Medtronic pacemaker or defibrillators in existence or yet to be developed. I developed, conceptualized it. I just brought back to the boss the information, and they took it and ran with it. The result was totally informative, he says. As the leader of the technological sophisticated manufacturing company that literally saves lives every day, Bill George used power of one observation to make critical decisions about the products that are Medtronic's lifeblood. Those observations showed him not only how to fix faulty products, but also a faulty organization. And they gave him the insight that spurred the development of new products. Before competitors saw the potential, George went to primary sources time and time again because he knew he didn't have enough information from other sources to make those decisions intelligently. At lower levels, command decisions come from the flowing of a set of rules. Things are quantifiable, and you need to know what the numbers are telling you, he says. But the higher up you go, and the more important the decision becomes, the more those decisions depend on the power of one observation. You take away a lot of unqualifiable impressions that way. Whether you are in the retail business, visiting stores, or you are in the automotive industry, noticing how difficult cars handle. George's power of one observation certainly paid off handsomely for Medtronic. During his 12 years of leadership, from 1989 to 2001, the company's market capitalization soared from $1.1 billion to $60 billion, averaging 35% growth per year. The next person, Mr. Simit, comes to town. When Ormin Simit joined Starbucks as chief financial officer in 1990, the company was on a roll. Howard Schultz, the CEO, was driving the growth and expansion of the company at a furious pace. Inundating major metropolitan areas with outlets that featured the best coffee, the friendliest baristas, the impeccable service, consumers loved it. The dense population of the city, such as New York, Seattle, Chicago, made it economically feasible to open multiple outlets, with some within a few hundred feet of one another, despite the fact that each outlet main's product cost only a few bucks. 10 years later, when Simit succeeded Schultz in the top job, prospects weren't looking so bright. Sure, the company now had 2,135 locations and was expanding into major foreign countries, but it seemed to some business analysts that Starbucks had saturated the major metro market in the U.S. At corporate headquarters, many of Starbucks managers did not believe it was possible to continue to increase the annual number of their store openings and were pessimistic about sustaining the company's growth. Poor Armin. It looked as if he would be the fall guy. The CEO who presided over the decline of Starbucks and the fall of his high-flying stock price. A reporter from Newsweek summed up the situation. After a decade of phenomenal growth in its North American cafe business, Starbucks now has a future out, an act two. Which is precisely what Simit set out to do. Simit not only believed Starbucks was far from saturated major metropolitan areas, but also asserted that there were many new opportunities as well. Simit, who had grown up in Chickasaw, Washington, a small town about 100 miles from Seattle, had long harbored the notion that Starbucks needed to be confined to big cities, although he hadn't denied that the company's operational strategy, a district supervisor oversees a multitude of outlets, lent itself mostly to big cities, where a supervisor's traveling time between stores was minimal. In addition to small towns, he also saw the unfulfilled opportunities of non-traditional places like lobbies of major office buildings, off-highway locations, and stores within other large retailers. He believed that pioneering those kinds of new territories would be an important part of maintaining a high level of new store openings and the profitable Starbucks, sharing the thought of opening stores in places such as Las Cruces, New Mexico, Sauk Falls, Dakota, the kinds of small towns in which he had spent his childhood. Long before becoming the CEO, Simit had explained his thinking to Saltz, a true visionary who believed in the potential of Starbucks more than anyone. But neither Schultz nor most of the management team shared Simit's confidence that annual store openings would be increased. Mid-level managers argued first that it would be too costly to oversee stores in remote locations. Either supervisors would be spread too thinly, spending too much time on the road or in the company, or the company would have to hire a lot more supervisors, each of whom would oversee only a few stores. It would also be difficult to supply remote stores with fresh baked produce. More to the point, though, management simply didn't think there were enough people in the small town willing to pop down $3 for a cup of coffee, no matter how good it tastes. When Simi took over CEO in 2000, he knew he faced an uphill battle. In 2000, he had people who believed that our rate of growth had to fall dramatically because they didn't think we could open more than 425 stores in a year. He says, growth has got to come down, and inevitable, it will. You can't grow in perpetuity of 25%. Where there's a time when you have to face that and say, no, that's the way it is. But I didn't believe we were there. In a sense, Smith wanted to go back to the future. When I was growing up and I went into town on Saturday, the streets were full of people. He says, I can go back to those same small towns now, and there's nobody in the street, despite the fact that the population is bigger. Where do they all go? Why don't they don't have any place to go anymore? The place where people use to congregate and talk with their neighbors don't exist anymore. I figure that we could provide those places. Smith wasn't just imagining that Starbucks would be welcomed in the small towns. For years, he had been talking to people who lived in small towns once they knew he was Starbucks executive. They wanted him to open a store in their town. Every time Smith went back to Chehalis during his tenure as Starbucks CEO, his old friends and neighbors would ask him when the town would get its own Starbucks. A few of his friends even pressed him to give them a franchise. Then there were the letters, hundreds of them. They came from all over America, written on small town mayors, chambers of commerce, and ordinary residents of rural areas. People from small towns were traveling more than they came across a Starbucks in their travels and loved it. They wanted one at home, and they took the same time to write letters to Starbucks begging the company to open a store where they lived. Requests from friends in his hometown for a Starbucks franchise and letters from small town mayors were statistical collaborated market data, just emotional appeals from people who wanted Starbucks near them. But the outpouring from all these potential customers was enough to convince Smith long before he became CEO that the demand for Starbucks' unique blend of coffee and hospitality was there in thousands of small towns across the country. As a result, he wasn't interested in hearing from the staff that Starbucks would have to cut back store openings. He wanted to accelerate them. Yet, the operating staff wasn't just imagining that remote stores would be difficult to run profitable. As Starbucks was growing through in the 1990s, the group that finds new locations had taken it upon itself to open a few stores in small communities in Spokane, Washington. The experiment seemed to prove their point. Sales were great, an indication that consumers loved having Starbucks in their town, but the stores weren't very profitable. The result of just the kind of costly management and logistical issues that the staff had said the company would encounter in a small town. When Smith pressed them to analyze the small town market, they came back with a gloomy prediction. Only 500 to 1,000 small towns had the demographic that would support Starbucks store. Smith didn't believe it. He had heard from too many people in too many small towns to think the market was that small. The staff was using the same demographics that we had in the metropolitan area to make their estimate, he says. I thought their estimates fell far short of the possibilities. Nevertheless, Smith didn't press his case. He admitted to himself that unless the company would surmount the logical management hurdles facing small town operations, it wouldn't make sense to move ahead. Then Smith took a fateful trip to New Zealand. It wasn't anything special, just one of a typical journey senior Starbucks executive routinely make to check out the company's foreign operations were going. The New Zealand operation was a joint venture between a franchisor and a Starbucks. Smith's first met with the franchisor's staff in Auckland, a big city in its own right, wanted to visit some stores. Just as he does anything he leaves headquarters, Smith wanted to visit some stores. Visiting stores to see how employees and customers are taking the Starbucks experience, it's like oxygen to Smith and other senior executives. They crave the experience and won't be denied it. They wanted to talk to people, ask questions, learn what's right, and as well as what's wrong. And, of course, they always have a cup of coffee during the visit. It's an optional hazard. I'll typically visit 6 or 8 stores a day when I am not in the office, says Smith. I love the product, so I'll have a cup of at every store, but I don't finish them. I have to throw some out each time when I'm leaving. Otherwise, I'd get wired pretty quickly. But visiting stores in New Zealand wasn't the same thing as visiting stores in New York, as he and a handful of New Zealand executives drove along narrow two-lane roads, passing hills, crops, and hundreds upon hundreds of sheep, Smith realized that in New Zealand, Starbucks was very much a rural operation. After hours on the road, they would pull up at a local Starbucks in a town of 5,000 or so. People will only a block or two storefronts, mostly small stores, selling the kinds of things farmers routinely needed. Inside the Starbucks stores, he invariably found happy customers. He also found the solution to manage rural stores. In small towns in New Zealand, the lack of other opportunities made a Starbucks store manager's job one of the best to be had. People competed to get the jobs, intent to make it their career. The franchisor was able to hire older store managers, many of whom already had retail experience and who could manage people. They didn't need district managers looking over their shoulders. Very few days to be sure they were doing everything the Starbucks way. Turnover of both managers and staff was exceptionally low. What's more, these stores had solved the logical problem of having fresh food in the store by sourcing into local bakeries. It was close to an epiphany for Smith. Here's how you run rural stores. He already knew the demand was there in the small towns, and now he knew how to manage the stores. So he badly wanted to put in those small towns. Smith brought his insight back to headquarters and put a team to work to figure out the logistics of distributing fresh products to stores located many miles away from the big cities. At first, they came back with the same answer that Smith had found in New Zealand: local sourcing. But with some more investigation, they found that even better solution, a flash freezing process that allow a regional bakery already serving metro stores to ship frozen products to stores many miles away. Once stored in the store, the food was as good as fresh. The solution made perfect sense. Real estate is small in small towns was much less expensive, and in major metro area, and the company could afford to build bigger store rooms with freezers in a location. With that, Starbucks was ready for the national outroll of what it calls new market stores. Just as in New Zealand, the managers' jobs in small town stores were converted to positions that attracted older and more experienced people who needed much less supervision by district managers. The flash freezing process provided fresh food in every store. The company began opening hundreds of new market stores each year and revealing in the reception they get. Las Cruces and Cerro Falls were two of the top performers. Simi's hometown in Chesalis has its own Starbucks Day, and sure enough, it has become a meeting place for townspeople. Simit, who is helping replace the community 100-year-old library, finds himself meeting with other restoration workers at the downtown Starbucks every time he goes back. There's no place that we have such an enthusiastic response as we have had in small communities, he says. We find things like a community of 25,000 people, and 10 years ago, we would say we are not going to have stores in a place like that. And today we have 3 stores there. And guess what? There are lots and lots of communities around the U.S. that have 25 people, for the market possibilities just explode. With this company's future growth in the line, Orrin Smith recognized that market reports, analysts' projections, and internal advice weren't enough. He then, with the certainty based on going to the source, conversation with the letters from the people in the small towns, and where a vast on top market was wanted Starbucks. They wanted Starbucks customers, but they weren't Starbucks customers. But they were wanting to be. That's what the market growth equation was rock solid. What he lacked was the solution of the logistical and management problems. Going to a different source was the only way to get it, because he was going to and consistently find the new information he found that solution in New Zealand. He hadn't been looking for it there. But had he not made the trip to that particular source, the solution might have eluded him completely. Reuters SpeedPass IBM. Whoa, through Mike Reuters, this guy is really unhappy. Reuters, the CEO of information infrastructure, powerful EMC, through most of the 1990s, was sitting across the chief information officer of Deere and Company in the CIO expansive corner office, listening to the tale of woe. It is bad enough to have to try to fix systems scattered across the company, but we would never have installed had they called us. But then to be able accountable for systems, I didn't even know existed, really irritates the hell out of me, said the red-faced CIO. The veins in his temples bulged. How about crushing my entire organization? They're all coming to call me. I have got to make over running and maintaining their data processing because they can't handle it. I told them not to do it in the first place. And now they want me to take over this mess? The only way I will take these things back is if they crawl under their hands and on their hands and knees over 100 yards of broken glass. Rutgers had been hearing similar complaints from other CIOs for the past few months. But now, where his vociferous, it was the 1990s that he used the computers, was exploding throughout industry. Every department in every company wanted dedicated hardware and software. If the IT departments couldn't keep up with the demand, individual departments and businesses unit took it upon themselves to create the systems they wanted, often without consulting the beleaguered IT department. But few department heads anticipated the problem that came with their own data system. They had to be staffed 24 hours a day, and more important, when something went wrong, their sedlam was anyone in the department who could fix it. That's when the department called either IT or the CEO, if it got the call. The technology specialists often found themselves confronted by a cobbled together system missing different hardware and software than the company's data entered used. It took much longer to figure out what had gone wrong and fixed it. If the CEO got the call, it wouldn't be long before he was on the phone to the CIO wanting to know what the hell was going wrong with the company's information technology department. It sounded to Rutgers as if Deere's CIO was fed up and wasn't going to take it anymore. Somewhat taken aback by the CIO's emotional outburst, Rutgers offered systematic comments, but at the same time, he was firming up the outlines of the new business for this company. I had seen bits and pieces that indicated disturbing or department data process was coming back to the mid data centers, but there wasn't any research or anything else that says, you know, 60% of it would be back in the next 5 years. Rutgers recalled, I had asked if he had seen any of that happen. and what question that question allowed him to articulate all the problems that he was having as a CIO. As a result of this, I called to a lot of customers, and the conversations would be useful, but not always particularly important. So, when someone reacts so emotionally, you know he has to be pretty deeply invested in what's going on. I knew that if he has this problem, other people are going to have the same problem. The key would be to develop a solution that gets it into the market faster than anyone else. If we could do that, then we would own a major new transition that was beginning to take place. What if, Rugerts thought, there was a device that could bridge the different data process system in a company like Deere and let them talk to the same storage system? Wouldn't that really simplify life for the guys like the Deere CEO? Nothing like that existed at the time. Not from IBM, not from Hitachi, not from EMC, and nobody seemed particularly interested in creating it until the idea coalesced in Ruther's mind. In fact, when he took his idea back to the EMC, his senior managers weren't enthusiastic. Business was just fine, they said. The company didn't need to be spending more money and effort chasing a product for which there wasn't a clear demand. Engineers working on EMC profitable mainframe storage products had absolutely no interest in seeing resources diverted from their project. The sales force was very content in keeping pumping out more of the products they were earning their quarterly bonuses. I had some supporters, but if you had taken a company-wide referendum at this idea I had, it would not have passed because we were doing so well on the mainframe side. Rutgers says, we had gone from zero market share to 35%, and we are expecting to be a half the market to follow the following year. We were gaining shares. We were growing like size. We were growing like crazy. Everybody was doing well, and the customers were very happy. Nobody saw any need to move into what I call the open system side or the client server side. But I was convinced that this transition was taking place, kind of behind the scenes. I wanted to get ahead of it because I always thought that if you get to the market first, typically you get most of the market share. Undaunted by the eternal resistance, Rukas told the EMS board of directors that he intended to create a new division to work on the development of a device that would allow different computers using different software to communicate with the single storage system. They said, Mike, if you want to try it, go ahead, he says. Wookers recruited an outsider to run the division since EMS didn't have that expertise in-house. Many of the 250 engineers who eventually wound up working on the development of the device came from outside as well. Wookers believe that creating a new division and keeping the development separate from EMS successful ongoing business ensured that the new project wouldn't get lost. In June of 1995, after 18 months and about $50 million, EMS introduced Symetrex 3000, which worked with a wide variety of servers, computers, and enable users to consolidate where open systems information in a single powerful intelligent storage system. Sure enough, EMS caught its first chief competitors, IBM and Hitachi, flat-footed. Hitachi immediately began development of a similar product, while IBM, apparently not believing the market would be big enough or lucrative enough, held back temporarily. At first, it looked as if IBM might be right. Reuters was confident enough about the Systemetric 3000 that he set ambitious goals for sale, captured in the slogan 2-4-8, which stood for 200 million in Symetrix 3000 sales in the first year, 4 million in the second year, and 8 million in the third year. Yet, at the end of the first quarter of sales, the company had posted only 15 million of sales against 25 million target. One of the things that happens when you set goals is that a lot of people react differently, says Wookers. If you set a goal of, say, making 10 puts in a row 5 feet, some people might think, yes, I can do that. But if they wind up making just 5 puts, they'll say, that's pretty good. Only a few would say, you know, I really need to make all 10. One attractive feature of Systemetrix 3000 was its small size. One person would carry the device in its carton. After he receives the first quarter sales report, Ruther spent most of the night stacking unsold cartons of Systemetrix 3000 in sales offices. It was this way of his way of letting them know that he was serious about achieving the sales goal he had laid out. The message got through, and the sales force buckled down to moving the hardware. In the first year, sales of Systemetrix hit 200 million target, and by the fourth year, sales approach $2 billion, constituting over half of EMC revenue. Mike Ruther's seminal idea and his decision to pursue Sysmetrics 3000 seem to have grown directly out of his conversation with an upset CIO at Deere and Company. But in reality, it came out of the 400 to 500 customer visits he did each year as CEO of EMS. Many of the visits produced only bits and pieces of information, but when a catalyst came along, like the emotional rant of dear CIO, all these bits and pieces suddenly became a coherent map that showed the way for a new product that revolutionized data processing and storage. It took Hitachi more than two years to bring similar product to the market, and skeptical IBM took even longer. You are able to do a tremendous amount of primary research when you visit customers, Ruker says. Research on this industry is probably about 12 months old when it is published, so you are not likely to find everything new coming out of the research houses. When you are trying to pick up early indicators of what's going on, you have to pick it up firsthand. The creation of Sysmetrics 3000 is one example of just how valuable it can be to go to the source for firsthand information. Rooker saw a market development before anyone else did, and move swiftly to take advantage of that knowledge. But that achievement pales beside EMS performance during Ruckert's earn in the 1990s. An investor put in $1,000 into both Microsoft EMS on January 1990 would have found that by January 2000, the investment in Microsoft would be worth $96,000, and EMS investment would be worth $806 million. Going to the source can pay huge dividend. Bill George, Orr Simit, Mike Ruckers are examples of the value of going to the source. Their devotion in the quest of firsthand information sets them apart from most people who feel inundated by meetings, emails, internal memos, and PowerPoint presentations. They produce the kind of market and financial success that clearly establish the value of going to the source. Where I do find the time to go to the source, you may well ask, follow our wise leaders, examples, and time will create itself. Once you realize how valuable it is to go to the source, you will find opportunities to do it more often and often than you imagine possible. Well, we will follow. We're going to be doing it, look, maybe like 8 weeks on this segment. And I know that this is going to be a powerful segment for each and every one of us, because we too, as entrepreneurs, can go to the source to get that needed information for us. So I am so thankful. I'll see you again on Sunday evening, and I'll see you again next Wednesday. And I am just so honored and thankful that I was able to share this time with you. So I hope you got some nuggets out of how the wise decide. And we are going to be spending, it look like, maybe about 8 weeks on this, because it's a lot of information that I know we can really gain traction on. The other thing I want to remind you to listen, last Sunday's segment when I had Wendy Oliveira's on The Art of Let's Play Chess. I tell you, it's a phenomenal book. I have it. I just began reading it. And I'm going to begin to use chess to turn my life around. So again, I honor you. I love each and every one of you. You are created for a destiny. Now, you know that you must line up your decision-making skills in order to manifest and demonstrate your success in life. So enjoy the rest of the week. I'm excited. I'm heading down to the conference for the National Association of Professional Women in New York City this year. So love you and stay blessed.
What's the plight that you've called me to? The thing I'm set aside to do. I trust you, Lord, to see me through. Will you let me look in your heart?
I know what I'm here for. Tell the Lord. He's a strong God. You may not be able to touch it right now. Begin to thank Him. Begin to praise Him. Begin to thank Him. Begin to praise Him. Begin to thank Him. Begin to praise Him. Hallelujah. Can you see it? Can you feel it? Everybody. You're going into a new dimension tonight. You'll never ever see it again the same way. You'll never ever touch it again the same way. You've been called with a great call. It's a monumental call. You've been called to change nations and generations. Come on and praise your God.